Okay, thank you for your time today. Welcome to Imagining the Past, the 2026 season. I'm Greg Johnston. HNSA acknowledges the traditional custodians of the land on which we work and live, and recognises their continuing connection to the land, water and community. We pay our respects to elders past, present and emerging. In this series of podcasts, we'll be hearing from the winners of the ARA Historical Novel Prize 2025, both adult and CYA categories. But we'll also be hearing from some other authors of historical fiction. The ARA Historical Novel Prize is now the richest genre-based literary award in Australasia, a staggering $155,000 divided between the adult and CYA categories and the Reader's Choice Award. The Historical Novel Society Australasia promotes the reading and writing and publishing of historical fiction through our biennial conferences and online programs. Imagining the Past is commercial-free. HNSA is a volunteer-run, not-for-profit organisation and can only continue to produce the podcast with your support. Please consider making a tax-deductible donation through our secure website. All contributions, great or small, are greatly appreciated. Malcolm Knox has written for the Sydney Morning Herald, won 3 Walkley Awards and a Human Rights Award. His novel, The First Friend, was shortlisted for the ARA Historical Novel Prize 2025 adult category. He somehow links sports journalism to writing literature, which is something I'm keen to explore. Welcome, Malcolm Knox, to Imagining the Past.
Hello, Greg. Nice to be with you.
You've had a long career in various forms of writing. When did you start to think about writing as a career, and how did all that come about?
Yeah, I didn't think about being a writer as a child. I was a big reader, but I was from a fairly conservative background, and you know, nobody knew anyone who was a writer. There hadn't been novelists at my school or anything like that, and it wasn't until
Where did you grow up? Sorry.
I grew up on the North Shore of Sydney,
right?
And I went to a private school, Knox Grammar, and the expectation was if you were good at maths, you did medicine or dentistry, and if you were good at English and history, you would do law.
It sounds like my school. There were 2 options. You could do anything you wanted as long as they were medicine or law.
Yeah, it was the same thing. And even though I actually liked maths more as a school student, I was also good at English, and I enrolled in arts law at Sydney Uni. And I was in my 3rd year when I decided to drop out of law, and to the great consternation of my parents, who I'm grateful to them that they gave way. They didn't try to fight me. By that stage, it was probably in the first 2 years of university that my reading stepped up to a different kind of level, and my ambitions turned more to writing, and particularly to being a novelist. I had no ambition or anything to be a journalist. I had no thought of journalism. I just wanted to be a novelist. So I was reading novels all the time. I kind of engineered my university studies so that they could just help me, give me cover for reading novels, and mainly French and Russian novels. And turning myself into a fiction writer. So it was probably at about, 19, 20, 21 when that originated. Having said that, I spent the next 10 years writing fiction only, and writing novels and finishing them and sticking them in the bottom drawer and starting another one. And I finished, now from memory, I finished 7 complete novels that I just shoved them all into safekeeping, didn't show them to a single person. And
really?
It wasn't until, and my first novel wasn't published until I was 33, 34. So it was a pretty long apprenticeship, and for, as I say, the majority of that time, I just wouldn't show anything to anybody.
So how did you get into sports journalism? That seems kind of a world away to me.
Yeah, that was a little bit of an accident. I fell into journalism through a kind of a series of flukes in my late 20s. So I hadn't trained at all or expected to be a journalist. I'd done a few other jobs while I was just trying to pay the rent and write novels. And I kind of lucked into a cadetship at the Sydney Morning Herald in my late 20s, probably about 27, 28 years old. And how I got into sports journalism, I'd done my cadetship. I was a first-year general news reporter. The Herald's cricket writer was retiring. They hadn't found somebody to replace him to go on a tour, and the editor-in-chief was talking to one of his colleagues, and he said, "Who are we going to get to go on this tour?" And his colleague, a man called John Huxley, sort of pointed across the news floor and said, "Oh, that young guy over there knows a little bit about cricket. Why not give him a go?" And for me, it was a bit of a godsend, because it gave me the freedom. It got me out of the newsroom. So I wasn't just, you know, chasing a story every day and trying to get into the paper. It gave me the freedom to travel, and again, it was sort of more cover for what I was really wanting to do, which was writing fiction. So I could go away on cricket tours and have a fair bit of time up my sleeve to read and write.
Had you been a cricket player before that? So you obviously kind of knew the game.
I was a very keen young cricketer, and you know, I heard somebody else say later in life that the ideal cricket reporter or cricket journalist, somebody who was good enough to, you know, to play the game at a pretty good standard, but not good enough to be a star. So you knew both. You know, how to play the game, but also you had a keen sense of your own shortcomings, and that was my cricket experience. I played, you know, representative cricket as a schoolboy and as a young person, but by the age of 20, probably about 22, 23, I realised I was definitely not going to get to, you know, first class level. They weren't well ahead of me, and I gave up.
Well, I would imagine, though, as a writer of sports, to have insight into your own shortcomings and see those in other players would have given you a fair bit of depth to your writing about it.
Yeah, and look, I never forgot the sort of the stunning impact it had when you came across players who were, you know, we're headed for first class cricket level. And then you'd think, well, I played against a couple of test cricketers, but you know, you just realize you were pretty good, and these players were several degrees ahead of you. And I think it helps as a cricket writer to have just the perspective of, you know, admiration in a sense for the skill level of people who play at that level.
So just winding back to your novels in the bottom drawer, did any of those get reworked or resurface at all?
No, No, I can't say I was embarrassed by them, but I fear that I might be embarrassed if I dug them out. It's a little bit like all of, for me, you know, I've never gone back and read any of my previous work, partly because I'm scared it'll be terrible, and partly because I'm scared it'll be, I'll think, oh, this is much better than I'm doing now. So
I am.
Yeah. I don't, they're in storage. They still exist, but they're deep in storage and maybe never to be seen again.
I heard a story yesterday of David Malouf berating David Marr because he had published a manuscript he'd found of unfinished manuscript he'd found of Patrick White's. So maybe you need to double lock your drawer in the storage unit.
Yeah, I don't think it would be anything I've done would be of the caliber of manuscript of Patrick White's, either published or unpublished.
Oh, you never know. They're going to pick the last bit of flesh off most carcasses. So where the hell did this idea for the first friend come from? It's kind of quite amazing.
Look, to be honest, Greg, I don't know. I think about 2020, I had written a novel called Bluebird, which I really felt I'd put everything I had and everything I knew about novel writing into that book. And everything I'd done up to that point culminated in Bluebird, meaning writing domestic drama, contemporary Australian, set in a beachside suburb, a world that I was familiar with. Bluebird really felt to me like an end point. And once I'd written that, I just didn't know what would happen next, didn't know where to go, didn't know if I had another novel in me. And then at some point during the COVID pandemic, I began to brood on, brood on the world, the state of the world, and I, Russian literature had been as much my heritage, well, more than Australian literature, because in those formative years that we're talking about. I was reading all of Turgenev, Chekhov, Dostoevsky, Tolstoy, and that was my kind of literary homeland. Much more that, and French novels more than Australian. So I didn't feel like I was going to another place. I felt I was tapping into my own heart, and. When in 2020, it seemed like we had this stack of autocrats sitting on top of us all, whether it was Putin, Xi Jinping, Trump, of course, in his first presidency, Modi in India, and then you had this sort of little tin pot autocrats like Scott Morrison in Australia. The response to that kind of despair was to look for, I guess, to look for a metaphor and some way into the pain I was feeling and the anxiety I was feeling, but some indirect way in. And look, I just can't remember what the moment or the trigger was that I decided Beria and Stalin were, the metaphor I was looking for. It just sort of came. And the material I think it was this sense of autocrats fictionalizing reality, making, using words to magic a new reality into existence, And if they said it often enough, it would become real. And you know, because I'd read so much about Russia during those years, it just felt, well, we've seen this before. We've seen it in an extreme way because of the, you know, the terrible things that happened, but also we've seen the playbook. And in the 20th century, the quintessential example of leaders talking a new reality into existence was the Soviet Union, and particularly the Soviet Union in the 1930s.
So is this your first historical fiction novel?
Yeah, it is. Look, you could possibly count The Life, a book I did that was, you know, loosely based on a surfer, Michael Peterson, who kind of was at his zenith in the 1960s in Australia. So a lot of that book is set in Queensland in the late 1960s, but that was as far back as I'd gone. And I'd actually had a conversation with a writer, Deborah Adelaide, a very fine writer and friend of mine, way, way back where I was kind of, I think I published something a bit critical of Australian novelists for using the past too much and avoiding the ugly present. And Deborah said to me, I bet you that one day you're going to write historical fiction. and I remember thinking, no, that's just not me. But 20 years later, here we are.
I've just finished writing a novel that's about the HIV/AIDS epidemic. And part of the inspiration for that was that it seems to have been forgotten, really. It's, you know, it ended pretty much 30 years ago, really, in the West anyway, not in the Third World. So in a similar way, do you kind of feel like the whole Cold War has been forgotten?
Yeah. I'm interested. My son, who's 25 years old, is very interested in history, and he loves. We sat down and watched a documentary about the Cold War not that long ago, and it struck me how to him it was completely fresh territory. And you know, not just the Cold War. When I think the Cold War, I think the 1980s and fear of nuclear winter and the Soviet Union of Brezhnev and his successors, and you know, Ronald Reagan and eventually the West winning the Cold War, so the very last phase of it. As for the period in The First Friend, not only was that forgotten, it wasn't really known in the first place in the West, because there was so much in the 30s, so much fear of Hitler overshadowed what was happening in the Soviet Union, and also the Soviet Union's subsequent alliance with the West recast Stalin as, you know, the savior of the world. The 1930s, what had happened was blotted out, and it was also blotted out by a lot of pro-communist people, and, you know, believing communists in the West. To the degree that, you know, even George Orwell, when he wrote Animal Farm, it's a critique of Stalinism from a Trotskyist perspective. But if George Orwell had written a true parable about Stalin's Soviet Union, it would have had all the pigs killing each other. Not just you know, imitating men. So, you know, the layers of ignorance and cover up, willful ignorance and cover up of the horrors of the 1930s were, you know, it's obvious why it was covered up in the Soviet Union itself, but the West was definitely complicit in that cover-up.
It's a bizarre time, for sure. The novel has a mix of real and confected characters. I mean, that seemed very daring to me. I'm just kind of wondering what some of the dangers or the challenges were for you writing those fictive characters amongst these, you know, for want of a better word, real characters.
Yeah, well, you know, it's not particularly original to insert made up characters into, you know, real lives, because you know you want some in, and you imagine a perspective that hasn't been provided by hard history.
I think that's true, and I think your novel kind of almost, as you've mentioned, you know, I was thinking of War and Peace, which is a very similar thing in that you've got this kind of fictive family in very real situation.
Yeah, it's kind of, you know, I certainly wasn't inventing something by doing that, but I did feel I was taking it one little step further, which was I'm trying to say that the record, such as it is, of, you know, the entire Stalinist period, but particularly the 1930s, was a fiction from the start, and there is no stable, you know, there was a lot of record keeping, but there is no fundamental record of the time that can be trusted, because, as we know, the you know, the written record keeping was fictionalized at its very, very source, and that, you know, that is extremely tempting for a novelist, and I'm hardly the first to be tempted by that. But it also felt very current when, and you know, this is even more the case in Trump 2 than it was in Trump 1. There's no foundation. The foundation's been pulled away, and so you are dealing in the material of fiction, rather than the material of hard fact that we're tweaking.
Yeah, I agree with you, but I feel like you did push it a bit further in that, you know, for example, Beria grew up in Murtov's family, but Murtov is completely confected. But that's a major, you've made that a major part of Beria's story.
There was a family that he was adopted by in Sukhumi in Georgia, and what we know of that family is that they were liquidated at the time of the Soviet takeover of Georgia in 1921. The brother figure is you know, a total speculation on my part, but you know, there was, you know, this is kind of what we're talking about, isn't it? Adaptation of what we know of fact to our fictional purposes, and that bit wasn't completely invented.
I'm just wondering if you feel you've pushed the story along the kind of continuum towards like an alternate history along the lines of something like The Man in the High Castle of Philip K. Dick. I mean, I'm not suggesting that you're at that point, but it does feel like you've moved along that point.
That's an astute observation. I've always felt I was well along that that spectrum.
It's a good strategy in writing to have a point of view character who's slightly outside and observing, which in many ways Murtov is, but he's not ignorant of what's happening. It's almost like he's reckoning how much of what's happening around him he can take and at what point he should get out. So it kind of felt to me a little bit, and it's interesting you've mentioned Orwell's Animal Farm, but it kind of felt to me like it was a bit of a retelling of Winston and Julia's 1984.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that, you know, thank you. It's such a that novel looms so large. But you know, I've also got to say it probably has its roots even more deeply in my own fiction, which is, you know, my main characters tend to be observers rather than heroes, and you know, passive, or it's the activity in their passiveness that interests me, and they're often the wing person to the chief actor. And I'd say that about nearly every novel I've written. The main perspective is the one just off to the side, not the person in the center.
No, it's a great narrative position to inhabit because it allows you a slight education of the character and the reader at the same time. So it's a nice device to allude to things, I think.
Yeah, you know, the step forward for me was to raise the stakes. You know, as I said, I'd kind of finished with the stakes of domestic contemporary fiction. The, you know, those stakes being you lose a marriage, you lose a house, you lose, you know, your dignity, whatever. But you know, I wanted to step it up, and you know, in the relationship between Murtaugh and Beria, we've got many of the same dynamic points as I'd previously explored, but the consequences for a misstep are, you know, rather than being a falling out and the you know, the grief and the feelings that follow a falling out, the stakes are life and death.
So you've kind of alluded to this a little bit, but how did you do the research for it? And do you speak Russian? And have you ever lived there?
Well, no, I don't speak Russian, and I've never been to Russia. A lot of
they don't the play research, cricket there,
which is similar to. Research and the life is a good example. I write first and then backfill with research, partly because I don't want research to take over, and I get very nervous when I'm writing a first draft and I just want to keep it going. So you know, getting bogged down in research is you know, another word for procrastination. So a lot of the research I did, you know, which you know, was through books and documents, not through first-hand experience, obviously, was done after that first draft period, and you find so much that is rich in you know, the modus operandi of the Soviet Union was never let facts get in the way of a good story. you know, to gaslight the population into obedience. Stories were chosen above fact when they could achieve that end. And as a result, when you're researching it, you find so many stories that are better than the facts, and stuff that, you know, you couldn't make it up. And you know, again, without wanting to belabor the point, that phrase "you couldn't make it up," which seems so apt to us when we're following the daily news today, was kind of a theme of my research, where I would stumble across something and I'd think, oh my God, whether that was true or not true, it is such a good story. I have to use it.
Yeah, I think the level of detail that you've got in the novel is phenomenal, and it really does makes sense that you probably painted that in later, you know, rather than letting the actual thrust of the story get hampered by worrying about that. So I think it's a good technique for people to have a think about when they're writing, that it's, you know, you redraft. I think people forget redrafting as the bit where you can put in these details which really bring things to life. The relationship between Beria
from
and...
From a craft...
You go.
I was just going to say from a craft point of view, for me it's all about rewriting. The first draft is just something, as I say, I get very nervous during a first draft, worrying that I'm going to run out of momentum. But really the object of a first draft is just to get it there, get something concrete down that I can now start the rewriting process upon.
Yeah.
And for me, I'm hardly alone, but writing is rewriting.
Yeah, I agree. That's where it comes to life for me. It's the first draft is, you know, literally blood on your temples. And then once that's done, I kind of feel like the fun begins then to redraft. So yeah. the relationship between Beria and Murtov is pretty complex. I was kind of wondering through it, you know, what actually kept them in this cauldron of friendship?
It's a good question. I think for Beria, we can see that Murtov is, you know, he's a bit like an old teddy bear, or Beria's rosebud, that keeps him connected to some feeling of happiness as his current life is getting squeezed more and more with the extreme stress of running a country, running three countries, Georgia, Armenia and Azerbaijan, as well as preparing for this visit from Stalin, where Beria has to, you know, excel, but not excel to such a degree that that Stalin thinks he's making himself look too good. So Beria is the one who's under mounting stress throughout. And a person in that situation, of course, they're going to hang on to the thing, the comfort blanket, more and more tightly. And that's what Murtov is for him, because Murtov is a living, breathing reminder of how Beria has been transformed from a poor orphan boy who was sold off by his mother into the boss, and he's the boss of the father, who Anastas, who bought him, and he's now the boss of Murtov, who was the, you know, the alpha boy, the golden child from this bourgeois family. The revolution turned everything upside down, and put Beria, you know, made Beria the alpha. So there's a lot of psychological solace for him in having Murtov around. For Murtov, it's obviously extremely complex because of the danger he's in every day. He can't make a misstep. He will lose his life, and even worse, he'll put his wife and daughters in peril. But in the writing of it, you can't just give that away, and that's part of the atmosphere of the place, that people can't speak the truth to each other. They need to devise codes of communication, as Murtov and Babylina, his wife, do. But the codes are never watertight or agreed, discussed even between the two people speaking code. So that's part of the drama, you know, how can Murtov convey to Babylina that he has a plan to look after them and to survive living under Beria, without speaking it aloud, And how can Babalina trust that Murtov has a plan when he's only able to speak it in code? The relationship between Murtov and Beria, to go back to your question, for Murtov, that must remain a bit of a mystery to us as a reader, because it is unspeakable to know whether Murtov is, you know, as dumb as Beria. Not Beria wants him to be, but it suits Beria for Murtov to be dumb. It suits Murtov to be Beria's dog's body. But we as readers don't know how real that is, and we're hoping like hell that Murtov's got a brain hiding behind all that passivity and obedience. And that's the main tension in the book, just, you know, hoping that he does have a real plan.
Yeah, and Murtov does have love and has a wife he loves and a family. So he has something that Beria doesn't really have. And he does.
Yeah.
Murtov also doesn't have aggressive ambition, because he has these other things that his energies are put into protecting in a way, whereas Beria doesn't have that, and he's just, you know, ambitious.
Yeah, yeah, and Murtov just wants to survive, but we don't know how much compromise that survival will entail. It's required a lot up to this point, but he's reaching the point where one compromise too many is really going to put his family at risk. You know, he's a gentle giant, really, Murtov, and he's a nice soul who history has delivered into this impossible situation.
So you've used humor in it. Like, it reminded me of Yes Minister or Utopia, with a good dose of sea soul, really. So it's a pretty bleak world, and I wonder if this novel would have been readable if you hadn't used humour. But I also kind of wonder at the consequence of reducing a lot of what was going on to humour.
Yeah, it's you know, the balancing act that creative work is was quite acute when it came to that. And the first person who read a draft of this, I've named him before, is Geordie Williamson, who's a publisher and a critic. And he's not my publisher. He's more, you know, I have an outside kind of friendship and trust with him. He said, if you're pushing the humour too hard and you play too much for laughs, you're letting them off the hook, and you're letting the you know, the real violence at the heart of that world off the hook. And it's a little bit like if we make too much of a joke or a reality TV show of Trump today, we're letting off the hook the real consequences of what's happening. So it was a balancing act, and you've put your finger on it exactly. The book needs that humour. The book demands that humour, but too much of it will let the air out of the tyres.
I mean, on the other side of it, it is quite violent at times. And I mean, in history, you know, the historical reality is that Beria was only really just getting going at that point. So I do most of my reading at 3 a.m. And, you know, there were points when I just kind of thought, thanks, Malcolm, I'm not going back to sleep now. So were the violent parts hard to write?
Yeah, yeah. And just look, I apologize to you, but also there has to be that shock factor to bring us back to, the consequences. And yeah, it is shocking, the violence, but again, I say if I squib that, I'm just letting the bad guys off the hook.
So we've kind of discussed this a bit. I just thought it was worth exploring a bit more. But there's a quote from the novel, "The truth, which got right up Beria's nose, was that the Georgian holiday was a fiction and Stalin had not seen Keke, his mother, since the 1920s. So whilst you're kind of illustrating these endless layers of fiction that the regime was built on, and like I kind of feel you've... there are tears in the fabric of the novel. Like you've got this huge cast and preamble, which is almost drawing attention to itself. There's really modern language through it, especially Australian idioms, hard word. You've got translations and puns on both languages. And I'm not sure if it's Georgian or Russian that you're quoting, because I couldn't find the words in either of them. So, you know, it kind of feels like you have built up this fiction on fiction in a way, and you've drawn attention to the fact that this is fiction.
Yeah. I'm playing very, very fast and loose with the truth. And that's because I'm a novelist. I'm not a historian. And a Georgian reader. I have actually been to Georgia, but after writing the novel, I imagine this conversation with a Georgian reader where they say, "Well, it's not like this, it's not like that." That you've really made stuff up, and I say, yes, of course I have, but it's for a greater purpose. It's even for Georgians, they knew at the time that their country had been made a kind of a place of the imagination for Russians, and it still is today, that Georgia is a bit of a land of milk and honey. And Russian people say, "Oh, well, I'd always like to go there, but it's so far away." And the Georgian people are larrikins, and everything's looser there. This is in the Russian imagination. Georgia was as much a place of their imagining as Australia is to many, American or European people now, that the picture they have of Australia is a certain thing that is not grounded in reality, and that was part of the rationale for the Australian idiom that I use, I wanted to be a picture of Australia as well, because of our relationship with the centre of empire. That has strong parallels with Georgia's relationship with the centre of that empire.
Oh, you're right, yeah. So the climax of the novel, without wanting to give it away, does seem quite predictive of the events of the last few weeks with the alleged attempt on Trump's life. And you've kind of alluded to this a bit, but good historical fiction should tell us a bit about ourselves. So what does The First Friend tell a modern reader about modernity?
I don't know if it tells us anything, but it's a portrait of how to live, how to survive under, how to survive amid uncertainty. And, we don't live under a dictatorship where people are going to be dragged out of their homes and executed. That's very much in the realm of literary analogy. But we live in a world of a devaluation of information because of its overflow, and like the people of the time I'm writing about, where we're kept powerless by the dizzying onslaught of, so-called information that is, there's just too much of it, and you ask probably you, me, and everybody, and the answer is, well, I don't know where to go anymore. I don't know where to go to find truth. I'm unanchored, and that makes us scared. And it also makes us crave authority in a way. So I'm just wanting to, I guess, provide an angled way in to that battle we face for certainty is the wrong word, because, you know, that opens another can of worms, but a sense of stability, a sense of personal anchoring in the world that we live in. I think a lot of us are just at sea, and this is a story of somebody, of a family, of a couple in particular, Murtov and Babalina, trying to survive when they are totally at sea. And, you know, in a way, yes, all there is love in the end. There's just love between them. That's the only anchor. But to say that would be overly sentimental and kind of silly to say love is all you need. Well, love is clearly, you know, a great thing to have, but it's not all you need. So, you know, in all the historical fiction you do, that you read and you study, and your audience, your, you know, members and historical fiction readers encounter, I think my book is very much at the end of wanting to say something about the world we live in today, rather than just very slyly hinting at the world we live in today while burying itself in a story from the past. So I'm at that end, and I'm quite comfortable to be at that end. But I don't think I have any answers. I've just got a story and a portrayal of individuals trying to make their way when there's no firm ground to stand on.
Yeah, I think we all feel that at the moment. It just feels like everything's changing so quickly and coming at us so quickly that there's no time for retrospection before we've moved on to the next event.
Yeah, and it's not like you feel in the dark. It's like there's too much light and too much stuff around. It's not like you're being denied information. It's that you're being given the real information as a needle in a haystack of pretend information.
Yeah, I think there's also an element of just bewilderment that, you know, things are happening that we never thought would happen, and it's hard to put them into place.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I'm a bit unashamed to be a humorist, because I do think satire is a really powerful tool of resistance and enlightenment, and as well as an act of defiance. Laughter is defiance, and a kind of a faith that history will vindicate. You know, the arc of history will bend towards truth, as it has with the Stalin era. And, you know, it's as bleak as that, you know, things that happened then were, we can gain some consolation in the fact that Beria is the unforgiven of history. He is the irredeemable person, even more than Stalin.
So what are you working on now?
I have a sequel to The First Friend coming out.
Oh, wow.
in September this year. Yeah, so I'm in the final copy editing stage of that, and I can give you a very nutshell summary. It takes place in 1945, and it's the next generation. It's Muratov's younger daughter, Milor. She's the main character. She's come back to the Soviet Union after the war breaks out. The chief characters are her, Beria's son, Sergo, and Stalin's daughter, Svetlana, who were both real people. So I've done that thing again of injecting a fictitious person into real lives. And the historical setting is the months between the end of the European war and the dropping of the bomb on Hiroshima. So the first day of the book is the day Hitler dies, and the last day of the book is the day Truman dropped the bomb on Hiroshima.
Momentous bookends for a novel.
Yeah. I think even more than The First Friend, this book, which is called The Second Child, is, you know, it's grounded in more familiar historical events around, you know, what happened between the end of those two wars, particularly involving Stalin and also involving Beria.
So you were shortlisted for the ARA Historical Novel Prize last year. I just kind of wonder what you make of all these prizes and what you think about them.
I think they're great when you're shortlisted for one. They're terrific, and when you're not, they're terrible. They're a, you know, complete lottery. Look, I've judged prizes myself, and I know what a kind of a random process it is, and how open to compromise discussions are between judges. So, you know, I've been publishing novels for 25 years, and I'm probably at an age where my chances of winning prizes have gone into decline, because panels now seem to, you know, they want new voices more. But, you know, I was probably a beneficiary of that back in the early 2000s when I was shortlisted for and won many more prizes for books that I'm sure aren't as good as the books I'm writing now. So, you know, I was a grateful beneficiary of what flowed then, and I'm grateful for whatever crumbs fall away now.
Okay, just to finish up today, a younger listener wrote in and told me that I should express my opinion of the novels that I interview about, which sounded horrendous to my formal education. But anyway, I think your novel was a standout novel of the ones that I read last year. I really enjoyed it, and I'm glad you've written a sequel, because that solved all my Christmas buying problems.
Thanks, Greg. I look forward to hearing what you really think of The Second Child too.
Okay, thank you for your time today.
Thank you very much, Greg. It's been great talking to you.
Thank you for listening to Imagining the Past, the 2026 season. Please remember to explore our extensive podcast archive, where you'll find a wealth of interviews. I'm Greg Johnston. Keep reading, keep listening. It's so good to have your company, Imagining the Past.